have any idea where the N4B is with respect to us? Semi.
The crew required information on the current position of the S4B, the final stage of the rocket which had been jettisoned away 2 days earlier. This short message hid an extraordinary turn of events. Apollo 11 wasn't alone in space.
There was something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be?
Traveling alongside Apollo 11 was a mysterious object, like this one filmed on a later mission. If the object wasn't part of Apollo's rocket, it could be only one thing. A UFO.
Tommy, can you hear me?
What?
Tommy,
can you hear me?
Classic musical about a guy who plays pinball, remember? Tommy, can you see me? He's the pinball wizard. There has to be a twist. Pinball wizard's got such a supple wrist.
Elton John.
The Who, you dork.
Oh, okay. Sorry, man. Sorry. That one.
Elton John does do a version of Pinball Wizard
right
later in the movie.
Okay.
Slash musical, but.
So, what was the movie that came out about the guy who plays the video game? It was like Pinball Wizard. It was something like related to that. It was a recent thing about, maybe it was Asteroids. It was like the movie that was, you know, I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think I do, but okay. I don't know what the reference is.
All right. Anyway, greetings, everybody. This is Wes.
This is the infamous Bubba Rob. But unfortunately, this week, we're missing the famous Mark Burnet.
Yeah, worldwide famous. Mark Burnet is away and in another planet.
In another planet or yeah. On another planet?
Most people go to visit other planets via the surface.
Given the topics I have to talk about today, he's probably in another planet.
Mm-hmm. And I have a theory that whenever you send a print job to your local network printer and the print job disappears,
yeah,
it went to a printer that's actually within a cave in a planet somewhere that has no doors.
Okay.
Nobody can get to it.
Or perhaps you should have used that whole reference as a postscript at the end of this blog.
So, this is a weekly show that I do with Bob O'Rob and Mark Burnet.
The premise being of which, or you decide the preposition you want to use, is that there's nothing new under the sun.
Right. Most new technological fads are just that, and they have usually had a foundation that started somewhere in the past.
Yes.
Really.
Not necessarily building on a series of inventions as the guy from BBC Productions did during the 80s and 90s Connections, but
okay.
Our premise is more that it's already been invented. Someone came out with a new wrapper and put it right around it and said, hey, this is high-tech, isn't it wonderful?
And what's,
I mean, there's a bit of the Connections going on because sometimes the ideas are put together in a more modern way.
Yeah.
But as opposed to that other guy whose name I can't remember, we're not talking about a synthesis of ideas. We're just talking about a rehashing of ideas.
Right.
Basically.
What's sad is that rehashing usually makes the company that's rehashing a lot more money than the original creator of the idea.
Sort of recashing of rehashing.
That's good. Recashing.
Is that like regifting?
Regifting?
Regifting. You know what that means, right?
Yes. Regifting?
Okay. Yeah.
When you've been given a gift?
Like, if you give me a fruitcake. Okay, let's say, not just a picture of yourself, but if you give me an actual fruitcake for Christmas, I keep it around for a few years. I never unwrap it. And since fruitcake stays good for about 5 years, I just re-gift it back to you.
I have a couple of stories.
Okay.
Do you have some as well?
Yes, but I'm going to weave them in creatively, or at least in a way that I hope at least one of our viewers thinks is creative.
Okay.
Or our one viewer.
Our one viewer. All right, so the first story that I have is this interesting this product has just been released, this Apple TV, the new Apple TV.
Okay.
And so you know about this puck device, right? This very small Apple TV, HDMI cable. You run it into your TV, and you can, and it works basically like the current Apple TV, but it uses the iOS.
So, okay.
So apparently somebody was able to hack this.
I also read that some Chinese company is putting out some device that lets an iTouch be almost an iPhone. I don't know if you read the same article. It was in Slashdot yesterday, I think. And as with all these things we mentioned, we tried to put a link in our blog notes about these so you can go find out for yourself later what the hell we were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. About. And this is located at www.slurpcast.com. As with a lot of newly introduced Apple products, there are a few companies that do teardowns. So they buy the device. They don't just blend it. They buy the device, and they actually tear it down, and they keep track of all the parts and the pieces, and they diagram it, and then they put it up on the site. So this one particular site, this one article that we'll put on the show notes, is the Apple TV teardown. Supposedly, the Apple TV, the whole gist of how it worked is that it would literally stream data from the Apple servers to the device. So you could rent a movie, but it would literally stream to your Apple TV instead
of
stored.
Like I would do with my Netflix to my laptop right now.
Exactly.
Or my iPhone.
Right.
I can't do it to my Android because I don't think they have the Android version out yet.
Okay.
Again, that's for you, Mark, making fun of me.
with the Android.
Like, making fun of my Android phone.
Well, my current Apple TV is nice because my bandwidth right now is so slow on the download side that I can actually say, download these podcasts, walk away from the Apple TV, and come back later, and they'll be there ready for me to view.
Okay.
So I have to fix the actual Wi-Fi problem that I have, but outside of that, I can actually still watch stuff by downloading. In this case, everyone was thinking it's just going to have enough memory in there to be able to stream, but it turns out there's actually an 8-gig drive in this thing.
Wow, so it can actually store quite a bit of data.
Some kind of data. Nobody's really sure like what that would be used for. Just interesting. 256 megs of RAM, which is the same amount that's in the iTouch and in the iPad, not in the iPhone 4, which has 512. Of RAM.
Anyway,
but there's 8 gigs of storage.
Anything else new on the Apple front that you and Mark Benet would have been talking about at this point in the blog, the audio blog?
He would mention stuff about that he's learned about Apple's new products. Probably would go into more detail about the Apple TV than I have. I will say, okay, one more thing that I'll add about Apple products, and then we'll be done. That I'll just read this that I got from the Apple Insider. It says, a report out of the Far East early Thursday claims that Apple has decided on its lineup of component suppliers for the fifth-generation iPhone and second-generation iPad, both of which reportedly obtain baseband chips from CDMA inventor Qualcomm.
Which might point to a link to Apple making a deal with Verizon.
Or just being able to support CDMA and GSM, which means they could go with any
other
CDMA.
Way, yeah.
Sprint, Verizon, what have you.
And finally break the stronghold that AT&T has on their phone service.
So it'll happen, and everybody believes it will happen. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, I think the world's going to change quite a bit when that happens because I think the iPhone is seen as the smartphone to have.
Yeah.
For user experience, at least. Even though I like my Android phone, if I had the choice of iPhone 4 or whatever on Verizon, I would have gone for that instead of the one that I went for.
Right. Well, you like the Android operating system. You're pretty familiar with it since you have the Google phone.
I'm not super familiar with it. I use it every day, but I'm no expert, and I haven't downloaded that many apps, especially the kind that Mark Benet would have downloaded. But we can segue into that with a story about a Segway.
Right.
The UK owner of Segway UK, I guess. I don't know what you want to call it.
Okay.
I'm sure everyone has heard about the fact that he drove his ruggedized four-wheel drive Segway off a cliff.
Right.
And unfortunately passed away. I'm not making light of the fact that he died, but come on. As Larry the Cable Guy would say, now that's just funny.
Right, exactly.
Or at least ironic.
And I think even he would probably say, geez, that's really funny.
I mean, I'm sorry that the guy passed away, but yeah. it strikes me as technologically humorous and ironic that you would spend all this money on a high-tech toy,
right,
and it would undo you, the actual owner of that toy, by not being high-tech enough.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like it's a tool. It's like anything else. I mean, you can use things for good. You can use things for bad. Unfortunately, without him purposely doing so, he used it for bad.
He didn't use it for bad. He just
made a mistake.
Didn't realize that, or maybe, you know, they need now to build in sort of a three-dimensional topographical look ahead. but maybe it's too hard to do on such a small axle width device.
My Roomba can tell when it's at the edge of the stairs.
True enough. So maybe some kind of sonar built into the front that when it detects any kind of tilt in any axis,
it stops
more than
fall
one
off.
Degree. It just freezes the wheels and grabs your ankles or something.
It stops, you tilt forward and fall off.
Or you have to wear a parachute or something.
Oh, there you
know.
Go.
Or at least some kind of Mercedes-Benz steering wheel airbag so that it pops open when you are flying through the air.
It sprouts wings and jet engines.
So if we can combine
anyway.
Red Bull and a Segway and some kind of airbag technology, it'll inject the Red Bull into you fast enough that you'll sprout wings and can fly away from the accident.
Can you draw a picture of what this looks like?
No, I can't, because I not have a napkin in the coffee shop we're in, which would be famous enough. No, I don't. I appreciate it,
right,
but
there.
My skills as an artist.
You don't want to go there.
Yeah.
I want to see what this thing looks like with all the... Anyway.
I don't think I want to take that idea any farther. Anyway, we're segueing into
wow.
another section of the show where I think I'm going to start a segment that just talks about space technology and astronomy and things related to SETI
okay.
and things like that.
Cool.
It doesn't have to be a regular segment of the show, but...
this could be a section for you, sure.
Whatever, but
yeah.
it has some good segues into Mark's kind of fart-based humor that I think would be good. I'll start with the more direct ones. I was a big fan of the Viking Lander project back in the 70s, mm-hmm. in late 70s, mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed it very closely when I was young. And I remember one of the experiments that was done on the Viking was looking for organic compounds in the soil. And there was a scientist at NASA who claimed that the results, which were inconclusive, were actually fairly conclusive and did show some sort of reaction that his experiment had been designed to find. Other scientists at the time argued against it, and he wasn't a senior scientist at the time, so it got kind of poo-pooed, and everyone said, no, there's not really life on Mars.
Okay.
Even though he claimed, and the first wave of news headlines said, maybe life on Mars, mm-hmm. based on that experiment. He's been a champion of those results for all that time.
Okay.
And they've been reanalyzed enough now that there's some more evidence that he was right.
Was it just a matter of like the technology not being good enough at the time to be able to prove his theory? Or
that was part of it, but it was also, from what I remember as a kid... So this is anecdotal evidence from
right.
a very fading memory.
Anecdotal, but it's not funny. Sorry. Go ahead.
But the response to that response was funny because it was my dumbfoundedness at being not able to come back with a witty rejoinder.
All right.
But basically, I think it was mostly political.
Yeah.
Anyway, they've done another series of tests with the new soil sampler on the current rovers that are still working. I don't remember exactly what's happening, but there was some evidence that, yes, indeed, there are some carbon compounds and organic compounds in the soil that did react a certain way. But that leads me to my second article, which is more of a segue, but not falling off a cliff segue, into something that Mark Burnet would really appreciate, because it relates to some ongoing data that the Mars orbiter has been noticing over the years that it's been monitoring the atmosphere of Mars, and there's methane in the atmosphere of Mars. And as you know, or may not know, methane is either produced from organic processes or volcanoes. And since the evidence they've found is cyclical, it can't be from off of Mars. So there's something producing methane
on Mars
in a quantity into the atmosphere of Mars, into the upper atmosphere of Mars, that is not possible to be coming from a different source. Either it's coming from some life process on Mars or volcanoes, but either way, it seems like Mars is telling us basically hello in the form of a fart.
Good, that's awesome.
And that relates enough to Mark's crap apps on the iPhone involving all kinds of interesting applications that involve scatological references. That he would appreciate that.
I think of Monty Python when I think that Mars is trying to say hello to us in a fart. It's like the last thing that we could ever think of in terms of an extraterrestrial life form trying to say hello to us is like by passing gas in our general direction.
Right. I think that's an appropriate reaction to life as we know it here on Earth. Especially if it was seen from, quote, higher intelligence from a different planet.
Just so, because they're higher intelligence doesn't mean they don't...
So the question I was going to ask you is, if the Pope is on Mars and he passes gas, does anyone notice?
I want to say that I think that's where L. Ron Hubbard currently lives.
Well, we were going to talk about that because one of the things that I brought up in our failed trial of this blog last time was that the largest diamond in the galaxy has been found about 50 light years from Earth. Basically, it's a dwarf star that's been crystallized. And so they've been able to tell from its resonant signature of how sound travels through it, or maybe light. I can't remember what the article said. But basically, they can tell that it's entirely crystallized carbon, and it's 4,000 kilometers in diameter. And I was saying earlier in our failed attempt that that's the only thing that I can imagine being stuck in the colon of L. Ron Hubbard that would have caused him to make Dianetics the anal retentive pile of crap that it is.
Have you actually read it?
No.
I read the beginning portion of it because my friend read it, and I've said this on the show before. He said that, that if you start reading it, it's an absolutely fascinating book in the beginning.
As a science fiction book?
No, as like a guide or a book. It just like this guy's views on life in general. He has these really great ideas that actually like make a whole lot of sense in the beginning of this book. It's fascinating and it grabs you.
So it may actually have some use.
Well, initially, it's just this guy's like thoughts on how things work. But then the book gets to a point where he starts to go insane. And the actual ideas get a little far-reaching, a little bit more far-reaching, until pretty soon he's talking about little green men that live in the middle of the Earth.
Okay, I think I can segue from the largest diamond in the galaxy being found inside the colon of L. Ron Hubbard to something else with that.
All right.
This is something I just found out last night. It seems that the best candidate for life in terms of a exoplanet has been found about 20 light years from Earth in a galaxy known as Gliese 581, I believe. I'm not sure about the actual number there, but it has a bunch of planets that are in the habitable range but might not be the right size. Like, they might be gas giants instead of rock-hard planets. Again, we're talking about gas and things lodged in hard places. But anyway,
we're not yet talking about
this one has 3 to 4 times the mass of Earth.
Okay.
And it seems to be much even more in the middle of the habitable zone of the planets of that solar system.
Okay.
It's a red dwarf planet, so the amount of light that the sun puts out is much smaller than our sun. And since it has a smaller gravitational pull,
yeah,
the planet is probably a lot closer to the red dwarf sun than our yellow,
yeah,
whatever it is called.
Okay.
So there's a higher chance of the orbital spin of the planet sinking with the orbit, or the rotation, I should say, of the sun. So it might be a little bit like the planet Mercury, which has a synchronous facing of one side of the planet towards the sun. So either it would be a slight wobble in the rotation of the planet as opposed to the rotation of the sun.
Right.
And thus there might be a small tidal area around the equator of this planet where life would be more likely.
Okay.
Or there would just be an equator.
Okay.
And a very narrow band of possible life.
Okay.
But either way, it's very exciting.
That is very
and,
cool.
And the thing that I think is cool is one of the researchers who's doing this search for exoplanets is a professor at UC Santa Cruz, which is my alma mater.
Nice. That's awesome. That is very cool.
But besides that,
so is the orbit of this planet decaying into its sun?
Well, I'm sure it is slowly, but they didn't mention that in the article.
Okay.
But so it's just the most habitable,
right,
Earth-like sized, yeah, planet that they've ever found.
That's awesome. That is very, very cool. Exciting.
But I was also able to make a few scatological references and tease the founder of Dianetics at the same time.
So I cannot segue in any way, shape, or form with any of my stories into... well, I'll go with this one. I'll go with the story, and I'll read this verbatim because it's interesting. And I know you're going to have a lot to say on this.
At least you're hoping I will.
I think you will. Got this from Boing Boing. It's a fairly old article by now. It's called The Case of the Broken Penis.
I can't say I have a lot of personal experience with that.
Well, I can show you the picture.
I don't really want to see that picture.
You don't actually see anything. So,
thankfully.
Yeah. Okay, gentlemen, let's see here. I don't believe this line that the article starts out with. It says, it turns out that the boner is just another bone that can be broken. I don't agree. The penis is not a bone.
I'm going to draw upon my great knowledge of the language and respond by saying nothing.
Scrub, Rinse, Repeat is the blog of prostate surgeon Amand Krongrad. The good Dr. Krongrad has quite a knack for describing awkward injuries in gory analogy. By the time I strolled into the emergency department, the young man's member had come to resemble a hybridized sausage, having the shiny, soft capsule of a fine Wisconsin bratwurst and the puffy corpus and purple coloration of a morcilla fresh from the pampas.
You're on your own on this one.
The basic gist. Erect penis gets bent in a way erect penises were not meant to bend, tearing membranes in the shaft and allowing the blood that normally does the job of erecting to leak out into other tissues. Sadly, that was not the case in this particular guy's problem. Only problem. The man shared that upon emptying his bladder... So the way that this started is this guy was having sex. And with his girlfriend, and they apparently did something where he was in an awkward angle and apparently twisted his member in a position that it's normally not allowed to go in. After that, the man said that upon emptying his bladder, his penis swelled. And it doesn't take a master diagnostician to deduce that in addition to the banal rip of his corpus, he had an exceptional tear in his urethra and was actually peeing into his...
You know, as
are we done here?
Well, I'm just saying that's really tragic.
Hence the Pillsbury penis. the good news is that it's fixable. The bad news is it's penis surgery. in this case, of Dr. Krongrad's patient. 4 hours of surgery involving something called penile degloving. Nobody knows how common broken penis syndrome is, but one doctor interviewed by Scientific American reported seeing a couple of cases a month. The lesson for penis owners everywhere, be careful in there.
I think that's where we should leave this one.
Done. But it is an interesting article.
It actually is interesting. It's just, I don't think we should make too much fun of that one in case.
Be careful, you know? Like, you don't want to break your, you know, urethra and pee into your penis.
I think we'll leave it at that. I'll sort of make a slight segue into the things that flop around in large bodies of water. Basically, it's been discovered by some scientists, I think in Norway, that it's possible to convert the skin of jellyfish into working solar panels by changing some of the chemicals that get absorbed in the skin cells of those jellyfish. And I'm not sure what the exact intent of that research was, but I think it was to have the cost of the solar cells go down, because obviously jellyfish can make a lot more jellyfish, and we don't really have to get too involved in that. Or, you know, therein lies the sting, or something like that. Or in the case of your last story, the rub.
The break.
I claimed I wasn't going to go there, but I think we just drove the car off the cliff.
Yeah. Into the nail.
I think we should stop making analogies there.
But it adds another level of, like you know, disgusting.
Stupidity? Anyway, I wanted to make that segue because I think research into that kind of thing is fairly interesting, but I'm not quite sure where it's going, because you still have to get the substrates that would normally be conducting the electric circuit in the solar panel into the substrate of the jellyfish skin, so I'm just not sure quite where it's going.
What's cool with this whole thing, though, on a higher level, is the whole idea of engineers looking into biomaterials to build devices that we can use.
I agree with that, because anytime you can change the mass production to something that's already a natural process, then you save a ton of money.
You satisfy the tree huggers, and you create interesting products.
Okay.
The greenies. Sorry. I actually pretend to be a greenie, even though deep down inside, I want to throw waste out into the street.
And launch it into space.
Exactly. Nuclear radioactive material into space, randomly. Just throw it over there.
Speaking of things that hurl things around, one of the stories I had from last week is just a little bit dated. The Large Hadron Super Collider in Europe, I guess. Mm-hmm. Or is it here? I can't remember if it's here or there. Finally got back working again, and either has now or is on the verge of surpassing the velocity of particle smashing together that all the other super colliders have previously reached. So the hopes of finding a Higgs boson is getting closer. And the Higgs boson being a particle that I'm not quite sure how, but is involved in finding a link between gravity and the rest of the unified theory of energy. Strong electrical, weak electrical, nuclear, and not sure the other force, of Einstein's, you know, unified theory of matter.
Okay.
So the Higgs boson is a very important thing for us to find. It theoretically exists. I'm not sure what it will do to prove or disprove how gravity folds into the rest of that theory, but it's an interesting thing. We were talking about things getting flung around. Not sure if the poo has hit the fan yet there, but it was one of the other articles I had.
Keymaster of Dozer.
You got me on that one.
Sounds like that's what that is.
But
Dozer. Dozer. Sorry.
Okay.
That, when you said that, I was thinking, oh my gosh, Keymaster for Dozer, or of Dozer.
I think we should use a bulldozer to get to the next story. So that was the one about the super collider. I talked about the jellyfish, solar panels. I talked about the early experiments for Viking lander on Mars. I talked about the Mars farting. I was going to segue into another space story where it looks like they found some natural bridges on the moon.
Huh.
And those would be the kind of natural bridges you would see, for example, along the shoreline of the rugged California coast.
Okay.
Where there's some rocks out on the ocean, and the wave breaks through but doesn't necessarily split the isthmus into equal portions like your current haircut, but turns one into a natural bridge where, like in the Southwest, you know, Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner would be running through these things, and one of them would be a bridge. So,
did they find denture cream in there?
No, I don't think so, but I think the bridges may have already been, they may have come down like millions of years ago, but they found evidence of these formations on the moon, so I'm not sure if that's left over from certain types of asteroid impact or volcanic behavior, but it was an interesting article.
Cool.
So again, we'll try to link that at the end of the blog.
Could be like water that causes those things?
I don't think water would have been mentioned on that, but that does remind me that I saw another article about the main moon of Mars, to get back to Mars, being Phobos, and how they detected that because of the composition of Phobos, instead of just being an asteroid that got caught in the orbit of Mars, it looks like Phobos was a melting reaction, like our moon, of something big hitting Mars, and then some of the debris or detritus in a high temperature state coming together to form the moon, which is currently the, I think, the more widely accepted view of our moon.
Isn't the theory that it came off of Earth?
Part of it did.
Yeah.
But I think in our case, most of it did.
Okay.
Not sure. I didn't read the article about Phobos enough.
So that might be one of the arguments against saying that whatever, you know, ice on the moon, you know, it may have been there when it was chiseled off of the Earth.
But
I don't
know. Question I have for a listening audience of one, perhaps more, is
1.3.
What is the other name of the other moon of Mars? Because Mars has two official moons. I know that Phobos is the main one.
Io.
I think that Deimos is the other one.
Okay. I thought Io, but that's not a moon.
No, that's of a different
Jupiter.
Planet.
Sorry.
And I think that even that moon is bigger than the entire planet Mars, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think it's probably wrong. Anyway, I think I'm out of space stories.
I got a racism story.
Go ahead. I feel spaced out enough right now.
So this I got from Boing Boing, because I'm getting all these really weird ones from Boing Boing. The history of African Americans goes back to Columbus.
Actually, that's the one that I told you about last time on our attempted blog.
Oh, we did talk about that. Yeah, but you pulled that one out of your head, so you had already read that one.
Go ahead, because you have more information about
it. Well, I'll just read the article. New DNA analysis done on the bones dug up from a graveyard in the Dominican Republic shows that Africans came to the Americas far earlier than anyone previously thought. The skeletons belonged to members of a failed colony set up during Christopher Columbus's second voyage to the New World in 1494.
Right, and the settlement was called La Isabella.
Okay.
It was inhabited between 1494 and 1498. The initial number of inhabitants, I think, was in the thousands or hundreds, and by the time they left, it was down to about 300 individuals.
Wow.
And they were able to tell the differences in the skeletons because of the carbon and strontium content of the teeth.
Okay.
Because the diets of those individuals would have been greatly different depending on where they were from.
Right.
So it's possible that slavery existed in the Americas shamefully,
right?
Even as early as 1494,
right? Yeah, not that pleasant, but it is amazing though that the food that was eaten back then had so little processed anything that people still had like teeth and whatnot. I think when they died.
As opposed to us, which...
We don't have our teeth when we die, pretty much.
I didn't know about that one.
That's not necessarily true. There was a lot of processed stuff back in 1494, I think. Sugars was still made.
I guess we could go crudely from that story about slavery to some new forms of slavery, which may or may not involve beings who are sentient yet, but may become sentient. And that leads me to two stories. The first is that the same people that brought you very loud bakery racks at the place we're eating, who seem to be people almost, well, I don't know if they feel like robots, but these, I'm waiting for the sound to go away. The people at either MIT or some Japanese university that taught a robot how to fold laundry are actually selling that robot either on eBay or something else for about $400,000. So if you want to have a robot that can match your socks and fold your towels, you have to pay that much for it.
But it can't put away my jeans or do anything else like that. It just only folds towels and matches socks?
I think it could probably be taught to do just about anything. But it leads me to my second story, which was... There's some more people.
There's a second rack of cooking.
Thank you very much. You might be able to tell that we're at an establishment that sells lots of baked goods.
I was gonna mention that. Like, where are we? But I guess where are we?
We're at Boudin's, a bakery cafe in San Francisco on Market Street.
And they have a really good BLT sandwich. It's actually really good.
And really noisy racks.
Racks.
Being rolled around on the tile floor.
You've gone into a room with noisy racks.
I have.
At work?
Yes.
Okay.
But anyway, I just wanted to mention that I think there's a theory out there that robots may become sentient or show signs of sentience soon. And I was going to bring that up as a target of discussion.
Huh.
Because, hey, how about that? Another noisy rack.
So this goes to the story of iRobot with Robin Williams. You ever
seen
that one?
Yes.
Yeah, the Isaac Asimov.
Yes. I Sing the Body Electric.
Yeah. That's the original to Blade Runner. At what point does a computer become...
Sentient. And my point is a long, long, long time from now.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
as long as we can unplug it.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I do, totally.
I like the idea of people who are computer theorists pushing this idea that computer intelligence can become sentient. I'm not arguing that that can't happen. But what I'm arguing is there's so much in our brains that is hardware-based.
Yeah.
Or...
I don't know about hardware-based.
But optimized into our biology that lets our neurons do much more high-level operations.
Where it gets interesting for me is when the hardware versus biochemicals or biomaterial merges. When we get to a point with robotics and computers, hardware, where we're actually like able to use material from the earth in a robot or in the brain of a robot, that's when it's going to get real creepy and strange. I believe a robot becomes sentient when you can take my brain out of my body and put it into the body of a robot and allow me to continue to exist in that robot.
Actually, I agree. I think that's much more
interesting. That's when it's sentient.
Well, I disagree with that idea of sentience because I think there are other ways to determine sentience.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think we should limit ourselves to seeing it that way.
Okay.
But if my brain could be put into some kind of pinball machine or washing machine.
I don't want to be a washing machine. Please don't make me a washing machine.
Your socks are done. By the way,
can I watch some TV?
Can you turn the channel? I'm really done watching reruns of... Yeah, anyway.
Can you tell the guy with the bakery rack to calm down? No.
But my statement being, there's a whole hell of a lot more that has to happen on a computer side than just some Eliza game pretending that it's a psychologist asking me questions that trick me into thinking that it's alive. Right. That's not a valid definition of sentience.
Well, it comes down to the core question that everybody will, that is the most controversial of all, which is, what is life? What does that mean? Can an application that rewrites itself or modifies itself be considered life?
Right. I mean, is working at McDonald's for most of your life considered sentience? Is pushing around
to people who don't have a job at McDonald's? Yes. To people to people who live in countries where they can't work and they need money and they can't get a job.
Well, they have farms and they can still be happy.
Well, I'm just saying. There's always a chain.
I think we're both floundering here.
No, we're bringing up interesting topics. We're not arguing. But
I do have one more link that I'd like to do at this point in the show, because this is where the famous Mark Bonet would be doing his craps part. And the only one I have really is the fact that I saw a humorous headline that said, "No fart apps around the rim." And that's rim computing, as in those little BlackBerry devices.
So what does that mean? What are they saying?
The owner of RIM was saying, look, we don't want to become an iPhone that has developers writing fart apps.
Right.
We want our users to have real apps to use and pay for those, rather than just some app that makes an interesting farting sound and then 5 minutes later they don't use the app anymore.
Like Android apps that are free. And although, how many?
I'm
fart
sure there's
apps...
plenty of fart apps for the
for
Android.
The Android. Okay. I don't generally gather crap apps like Mark Bernay does. And I'm not really intrigued. Well, they're interesting, but only interesting for the first 5 seconds, and then I'm done. Like Bob was saying, with fart apps. But I do have some apps that I can share that are relatively unique. VLC was recently released. With Apple's new lenient App Store policy, they are allowing interpreters to exist in the App Store. And VLC is an interpreter in the sense that it recognizes many codecs. You can give it AVI files and it will actually play those back on an Apple iPad, which before could not play those.
Right.
And VLC is free. It needs a little bit of work on the larger sized AVI and DivX movie files, but to see it play back all these other formats is really great, and it opens the doors for a lot of developers to come up with some interesting applications. On that note, the application that was once allowed and then shut down is now back. It's called C64. C64 is a Commodore 64 emulator that allows you to literally download games, the original code for Commodore, and run them.
Now, you're showing this to me on your iPad. Does that mean it's available for the iPad and the iPhone and the iTouch?
It is an iPhone app, which means it runs on the iTouch and the iPhone, but it also runs just fine, like I'm showing you here, on the iPad.
Okay.
Let's see if I can get it to go.
Oh, yeah.
You remember this?
Yeah.
This is one of those games that we all knew and loved on the Commodore 64. It's called Mr. Lee or something like that.
Some kind of ninja game, yeah.
It's a ninja game. And I'm actually doing pretty well playing it upside down. But it's great to have the nostalgia. You know, it's great to see games available on the C64, on the iTouch, iPhone, what have you.
I guess that brings me to one of my last stories, but I'm just remembering this one. I don't have it written down, but it seems like there's a lot of interesting stuff going on at universities around the iPad, and whether or not it's appropriate for having a university or not. There are some people that claim that it's reducing the amount of paper needed to be a student enough that it should just be allowed.
Yeah.
There are others who consider it, I guess, a security risk because it's so easy to take pictures of... I'm not exactly sure what the risks are, but it's just sort of a fight between traditionalists and technologists. Should people be taking notes on an iPad? Should they be taking notes with pen and paper? If they're doing it with an iPad that eventually has a camera,
right,
is that a copyright violation?
Mm-hmm.
How do they download and share copyrighted material on the iPad for classwork? You know, what's the final decision?
Right.
The article that I was reading was saying that universities in Australia were kind of latching onto the idea as being something great. Mm-hmm. There was another statement in the same article, which I can't remember where it is, saying that some universities in the U.S. were fighting against it very strongly.
Okay.
So maybe you have more information on that.
Well, I've heard the argument in other podcasts. I know Twit was one of them, where they were talking about web-based services where you could go rent a book. Now, it's just literally the license to use a book, and you could download it onto your iPad or iPhone or what have you to read and while you're going through the class. And then after a certain period of time, it expires and it goes back.
Right. But both of us know from our long-term experience in the computer industry, once it's digitized and it's on any kind of computer device, it can become a billion copies in about a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it has wireless connectivity, it's impossible to put a lid on that.
Yeah.
Which I guess we should bring up the Stuxnet virus that was recently troubling Iran's infrastructure.
I don't know about that.
It was pretty widely reported. Stuxnet, the Stuxnet. I'm sorry. Stuxnet virus that got into Iran, and apparently has been wreaking havoc with a lot of their PLC-controlled environmental systems, like dams and electrical, not circuits, but you know, infrastructure.
Okay,
and how that hasn't happened before because there's never really been a good open door into those PLC-controlled devices. But now that some of those PLC-controlled devices are being beta or meta-level operated by Windows...
Okay.
Great.
Okay. use the one operating system that's most widely written viruses for, or widely written for viruses...
There have been some people that have been able to break into that. But there was also discussion of whether or not that Stuxnet virus was designed by a high-level espionage team from a different country, given Iran's current nuclear swashbuckling.
Like the U.S., maybe.
Or maybe Israel. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up.
Interesting.
I think we're nearing the end of our time.
We are nearing the end of our time. So, I guess we can wrap it up. I don't have any more stories.
That's all really I had. I tried to make enough scatological references that Mark would be happy.
I think he would be. It's pretty cool. I think we did a good job. So again, just to go over it, if you're interested in listening to any of the reading any of the articles that we have that we were talking about in this particular show, you can go to our blog, which is at www.slurpcast.com. It's also a blog where you can actually make comments and share ideas on the stories with us. So we encourage you to participate by adding comments.
And again, we're talking to our one listener.
Yeah. The one listener. Bob, thanks for doing the show. Thanks for your interest. And this is the sort of thing that if it does grow into something bigger, we can always look back on this and say, remember the time when we were making no money at this? We had our daily jobs, and we thought it would be entertaining to do this sort of a show.
Maybe in some alternate reality. on the other side of that largest diamond in the universe.
Exactly.
On the planet.
In the planet.
581 Gliese 9F or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
That's going around that red dwarf star.
I'm going to be in that room with the printer looking at all the print documents that people sent accidentally.
And now, appropriately, that's being added as a postscript. Which is usually what the problem is related to in the first place.
Yeah, it's true.
And that can be in your humble Adobe, who's wow. the creator of PostScript. And I think we should leave it at that pun.
Yep. All right. Thanks, guys.
See you.